WDIY News is pleased to welcome back Dr. Jeffrey Jerry for a Lehigh Valley coronavirus update. He is the Senior Vice President of Medical and Academic Affairs and Chief Emeritus of Infectious Disease Specialists with St. Luke's University Health Network. Welcome, Doctor. How have you been?
Hi. Oh, I'm pretty well, and I hope you are too.
I am, and thank you for asking. Let's jump right in. The president recently inferred that the possibility of injection of disinfectants, UV light therapy, or use of bleach could be effective against coronavirus and COVID-19. Are these effective therapies?
It's very important to understand the difference between an antiviral or antibacterial drug that one takes by ingestion or injection and a disinfectant, which is used to clear a surface. They're very, very different. Most disinfectants are toxic when ingested or injected, and that's certainly the case with things like bleach. So that has resulted in significant harm, and some of the people who took that statement literally. It's very important to know that what you use to clear a surface like a countertop is not, and I repeat, is not what you would use to clear an infection from your body.
Plans are moving forward with the opening of the Pennsylvania economy slowly. How is St. Luke's University Health Network planning for a spike in infections?
We've always said that you have to plan for the worst, but that doesn't mean that we don't expect the best. And in this kind of situation, what I can be certain of is that we are in a much better position if there is a second surge than we were in the beginning. Why do I say that? There are really two reasons. First of all, we've learned a lot in the several months that we've had patients with COVID-19. We now know better methods that we didn't have initially to help treat patients and get them better, quicker, and out of a hospital faster than we knew just as early as 6 weeks ago. Secondly, we've made much better use of our personal protective equipment. It's fair to say right now, because of many of the initiatives that we've undertaken, that we actually have much more personal protective equipment now than we did at the beginning of the onset of the COVID-19 epidemic. So if there is a second surge, we're fairly confident that we can handle it certainly better than we were in the beginning of the epidemic. And even with that, it didn't overwhelm our system. So I'm optimistic that if it does occur, we'll be far better off.
Will St. Luke's University Health Network resume elective surgeries, and how will it do so safely?
That's a very important question, and the answer is yes, we are going to resume elective surgery. We're planning right now for May the 11th when that will take place. You may know that some elective surgery has already been done, and that elective surgery would be classified as something that could be dangerous if it were put off, for instance, cancer surgery as an example, or if a person was in intense pain and needed to have the surgery done in order to alleviate that pain. That has been already taking place. But other elective surgeries will be done as of May the 11th. The safety of our patients as well as our staff is always our highest priority and remains so in terms of the initiation of a broader band of elective surgery. What we're going to be doing is any patient that comes in for elective surgery will have a COVID-19 test that will give us an indicator whether that person has active COVID-19 or not. And if they do, then most elective surgeries would be put off until they were clear of the COVID-19, because there is a higher complication rate if you actively have the infection. That's number one. Number two, they would be in a separate area of the hospital that does not have COVID-19 patients. COVID-19 patients are isolated in certain other areas. That would not be the areas where we would have patients who are in for elective surgery. And they would be cared for by staff who are not taking care of COVID-19 patients. So with all of those things, plus using universal masking that we have taken to the nth degree right now, we can be very certain that both our patients and our staff would remain safe and the surgery would be able to be done appropriately and safely.
I understand that St. Luke's has partnered with Lehigh University Department of Engineering to create a bug zapper, which sterilizes N95 masks. Can you tell us more?
We're very proud of the innovations that our staff has come through with in combating the COVID-19 pandemic. And many of these innovations have put us as not only a national leader, but an international leader. The invention of a ultraviolet system that can safely and efficiently sterilize respirator masks like N95 has been one of those innovations. And it was done with a team of people from here working closely with people who specialize in photonics and mechanical engineering at Lehigh University. The system that we came up with allows us to safely sterilize N95 masks as many as 5,000 in a 12-hour period. And we know by doing virological tests on this that it absolutely works and doesn't destroy the integrity of the mask. This has been patented and has gotten actually international interest. It is a major advance, and it's one of the things that I was referring to, and I said that we're in a better position now if we were to have another surge than we would have been in the beginning of the epidemic, because we have mechanisms like this that allow us to expand our use of N95 masks.
The UV process works in sterilizing N95 masks, but it's not meant for human use.
No, actually, that dose of UV light would be toxic to someone's skin. It would actually give you a burn. So the way this has been designed is that it's a contained apparatus, that the operator is not exposed to the UV beam.
Doctor, has the infection curve been bent in the local area?
The answer is yes, absolutely. You can take a look at our hospitalizations, which I think is a very objective indicator of the amount of patients that we actually have with this disease. If you just took a look at positive tests, that can be misleading, because the more tests that you do, the more positives you're going to have. And obviously the reverse is true, that if you don't do testing, what you don't see, you're not going to find. But the rate of hospitalizations, I think, is a very good objective indicator. About 6 weeks ago, we were seeing as many as 100 to 140 new COVID patients come into our network hospitals on a daily basis. About 3 weeks later, it had dropped down to about 60 to 70. And now in the most recent 3 or 4 days, we're seeing about 30 new patients with COVID-19 coming into our network hospital. So we know that there is less COVID-19 out there in the community. That gives us, I think, good reason to say that the curve has indeed been bent.
Can we say, Doctor, that we're in the tail of the first wave of infection?
I would certainly say that it looks that way. It remains to be seen whether this will continue now that there will undoubtedly be some relaxation in terms of what businesses can reopen and what people can do out in public. If everything goes as planned, I think we can say that we are in the first wave, and hopefully we will not see a major resurgence. But again, that's a hope at this point in time, not an actual fact.
Is a second wave still conjecture at this time?
It is. A second wave is still conjecture, and we don't know when and if it's going to occur. There are many people who feel that if this progress continues, that we'll hopefully see a major decrease by the summer, but there is a fear that we could see a resurgence in the fall, and we'll just have to see whether that comes through or not.
OraSure and B. Braun are local companies developing antigen tests and utilizing infusion pumps to combat COVID-19. Does St. Luke's University Health Network work with local companies to advance their products to market?
We are currently involved in at least 7 different studies of various products and testing material that have to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. And some of these companies are local, some of these companies are international. We have, in fact, worked with the companies that you've mentioned in the past, and we look forward to doing that work with them again. We're certainly available to do so.
Dr. Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force suggested that antigen testing is the needed breakthrough that we need. Do you agree?
I think there are a number of different breakthroughs that we can be looking at, whether it's antibody testing that's absolutely reliable, that would certainly be helpful, and antigen testing that can also be in that phase would be very helpful. Right now, both of those things are, even though antibody testing is available, the reliability remains to be seen, and the same is true with antigen testing. So I think I'm going to hold my opinion on that until we can see what the true worth of the tests that come out are.
Last week, St. Luke's University Health Network announced its 500th COVID-19 discharge. What is recovery like for someone who returns home?
Well, I'm happy to say that we're now up to about 650 patients that have been discharged from our hospitals with COVID-19, and that's really quite an accomplishment. One has to remember that the vast majority of patients, and we always have said more than 80% of people who have COVID-19, never have to be admitted to the hospital, and so their recovery at home, since they're less ill, is very, very different than the patients who do get admitted, and that's less than 20%, who obviously are the sickest patients. And within that group, you have some people who have required mechanical ventilation and others who do not. So it's a very mixed group of patients, and their recovery time is equally mixed. I think it's fair to say that at the very least, if someone has been hospitalized for COVID-19, one doesn't immediately, when they leave the hospital, go from being in a hospital setting to being perfectly well the next day as they were before they got the disease. At the very least, because there's less activity that goes on because people are ill and they're fighting an active infection, there's definitely going to be some weakness and there's going to need to be some type of rehabilitation and trying to get people back to their normal working environment. There also may be shortness of breath and some symptom persistence, such as a cough. So all of this is very variable, but I think it's fair to say that a patient who leaves a hospital, who's been sick enough to be in a hospital, will be looking to a recovery time of very likely several weeks at best.
I'm not seeing video news reports where, you know, they're running out the front door. They're usually being let out with wheelchairs and their staff around them.
That's exactly right. Again, there's a transition that has to take place, and that's true of any illness that requires hospitalization.
Does St. Luke's University Health Network offer support, mental support, for frontline workers to deal with the strain of the job?
Absolutely. We know that this pandemic has created a tremendous amount of issues that are both economic, that are mental, for the entire population. And it's no different when you're talking about healthcare workers or first responders. There is also certain issues, and that tend to be more unique because of the intensity of the involvement. Again, the health of our employees is of paramount importance to us, and that includes their mental health. So we've arranged a number of different platforms for people to be able to get the help that they may need, the counseling that they may need to deal with the pandemic. And they range from virtual visits to actual face-to-face visits. They can be online information. Some of these can be also done anonymously if that's what the employee chooses. And in addition, we have a number of different programs that will help alleviate stress for employees because we know that that's a big part of this as well. So it's a whole package, and we're prepared to deal with that because, again, everyone is an individual and requires different kinds of support, but we do know that it does create a strain on everyone.
Will this be the fastest antiviral developed and produced for the market?
I would certainly say so. Generally, when we've talked about vaccine development in the past, you're talking about a process that takes years, in many cases up to 5 years, to have something from concept to an actual rollout if it works. Clearly, that would not be acceptable right now. We have different methodologies that help us accelerate that. Currently, there are at least 8 different vaccines that are in active testing phases. There are certainly some predictions that some of these vaccines might be available for a more robust rollout as early as the late fall and quite possibly by the first of the new year. We certainly hope so. It's very important, I think, when you're dealing with a pandemic, which by definition is worldwide, that we not rely on just one vaccine type or one vaccine maker. And so that the idea that there are multiple different companies that are working on this through different kinds of concepts, I think, is a very healthy one. And it's actually awesome to see how much progress has been made in the few months that we have had an acquaintance with the COVID-19 virus, remembering that the first cases really weren't apparent until December of 2019. And here we are, not even 6 months later, and we're already in active testing of a vaccine. So I'm optimistic that we're likely to have something that is both safe and effective sooner than later.
Dr. Fauci has suggested vaccine doses in the millions are possible by January. Do you concur?
Yes, I think there's good reason to have that kind of optimism based on the progress that's been made so far. But again, all of these are their hopes. They're based on some scientific knowledge, but actually coming up with a true, safe, effective vaccine, it may be a lot harder than some of the projections. So it remains to be seen, but I believe that there is some very reasonable cause for optimism.
Prospective therapeutics such as hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine have disappeared from the media attention because of the efficacy has been challenged and reportedly largely refuted. Is St. Luke's University Health Network still using chloroquine on patients, and what are the defined results they have found?
As with all therapeutics right now, we're in the early stages of looking at their efficacy. And these drugs are not being used alone. They're being used in combination. We have never advocated the use of hydroxychloroquine in outpatients because of the potential dangers that can occur in terms of heart rhythm disturbances. Currently, we are using it in combination with other drugs for certain inpatients that are closely monitored. At this point in time, I think I would not rely on that drug, and we have not been relying on it, but we have used it in what we think may be successfully in a number of patients, and certainly safety is paramount in that. So these patients are inpatients, and they're getting constant readouts in terms of their heart rhythm to make sure that there isn't any toxicity. Further studies, and that's what the conclusion has been. When you look at the absolute studies that have been done by the Veterans Administration or others, further studies are necessary to really define whether there is or isn't a place for this drug in terms of fighting COVID-19. It remains to be seen.
And letting patients simply walk out of a medical facility with this to take home is clearly something that's not part of that equation.
That is not part of that equation, and never has been.
Is St. Luke's University Health Network using remdesivir? And it has obviously seen a recent blind trial with a small control group yield marginal recovery results of 30% less time needed. Is this a witnessed result with St. Luke's University Health Network?
We're the first hospital network in our region to have been approved for the expanded access program for remdesivir. And we are, in fact, using it and have used it. One of the things that has not been really critically evaluated is the release of the information about remdesivir.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to listen to what Dr. Fauci said and what he didn't say. He didn't say that this is a cure. He said that this is potentially a major advance. People are now looking at this, oh my gosh, now we've got this thing over here and it's really going to be revolutionary. I believe that's a bit of a stretch right now. There are some very cautionary things to say about this, just as we said with hydroxychloroquine. The true place of remdesivir in the treatment of COVID-19 still remains to be defined. We know that there was this one study that has given us some optimism of roughly 1,000 patients. That was an international study. And it's important to know what it didn't show as well as what it did show. Originally, the study was designed to show that there might be a difference in mortality. It was quickly seen that there wasn't going to be any difference in mortality, and in fact, the study showed no significant difference at all in terms of mortality versus a placebo. So that is something that it doesn't do. We don't, at this point, feel that there is any evidence that it, quote, saves lives. What the study did show was that there was a reduction of about 4 days from the length of hospitalization that a patient had who had COVID-19 who took the drug versus someone who was on a placebo. In other words, it went from 15 days down to 11. When we use the drug, we are not using it under study conditions. And what that means is we're not actually using a control group who's getting a placebo. We are giving the drug to people who qualify for it, and it's either a 5 or 10 day course. It's too early to say whether we have actually seen a drop in hospitalizations because we don't have a comparator group. And all of our data is being fed into a national registry, and hopefully some of this will become clearer in the future. But I think it's particularly important for our listeners to know that although this represents a potential progress in terms of something that might be beneficial, it is not the magic bullet that represents a cure, nor has it changed mortality.
So a new buzzword that's somewhat come into the frame in the last 3 days is convalescent plasma. Can you speak about that?
We have used convalescent plasma and continue to use it. It is a methodology that goes back to the 1890s, where you take plasma, which is a clear part of the blood from a patient who is recovered or recovering from an illness and has then developed antibodies to help fight that particular invader. And what you're doing is transferring that plasma, which has that, those fighting antibodies, into a patient who's ill and who hasn't made their own antibodies yet, with the hope that using someone else's antibodies will help them get better quicker. So again, this is a preliminary situation. We've had some good results, but this is not something that is going to work in every patient. And we're very proud to be part of a national group that's overseen by the Mayo Clinic, and the data is first being accumulated, and time will tell how valuable this is and in which patients, if any, might benefit the most.
And you mentioned increasing your capacity to contact trace. Is that also expanding and growing?
Yes. As you know, there was a plan by the state of Massachusetts where they hired several thousand workers just to do contact tracing, and Governor Wolf has announced that he is planning on doing something similar. And he's also asking for the cooperation of the local health departments and hospitals, and we certainly are planning and are doing that right now. We are actively involved in contact tracing, but we know that a lot more can be done.
How do you feel social norms will change, like the handshake? How do you think society, local and around the world, will change?
I believe it actually is going to make some very big differences in many of the things that we're doing. Handshakes may be one of them. Certainly working from home is another. It's been estimated that before this epidemic, about 4% of our workforce worked from home, and currently about 25% do. As we're finding that that is a successful way of conducting business, I have every reason to believe that in many cases that will continue. And in terms of actually being aware of disease transmittal, and we know that if COVID-19 never existed, that we can certainly transfer the common cold and diseases like influenza by contact with our hands. I believe that there are going to be some very permanent changes that we're going to be seeing in terms of society as a whole and their awareness of how many infections are spread.
Seems like therapies or an eventual vaccine are or equal consumer confidence. Is that fair to say?
I absolutely believe that you are correct. There are only two things that I think are going to restore us to a sense of normalcy that existed before all of the COVID-19 became a fact of life. One of those would be if the epidemic kind of stopped dead in its tracks. And we know that that's happened with certain other epidemics. We don't think it's likely with COVID-19, but obviously if all of a sudden there ceased to be any new infections, that would end up being the confidence builder that we needed. So it's not likely. The second is the development of a vaccine to prevent this, and that would be even more important than a treatment. I'm not certain that a treatment would absolutely make us go back to where we were before in terms of normalcy, but a prevention certainly would. So everyone is looking forward to the development of a safe and effective vaccine. I believe that is going to be the true game changer or magic bullet that we need in order to restore confidence in society that we can go about our life in a manner that was similar to what existed prior to the onset of this pandemic.
Finally, what else would you like our listeners to know?
The only other thing that I think is very important for people to kind of be aware of, you had mentioned about antigen testing, and we've talked a little bit about antibody testing and as well. There is right now a plethora of test kits that are being marketed direct to consumer and in many cases for home testing. I want to make certain that people understand that most of these have not been well tested. They do not have the same kind of validity or reproducibility that a test that's conducted by a certified laboratory does. And so the advice is the typical caveat emptor, which is let the consumer beware. I would caution people to not buy the home testing kits right now that exist for COVID-19, and that they should be in contact with their primary physician if they are interested in any particular type of testing, and they can get the proper advice that way, but not to go and do the homegrown things, because at this point in time, there's too many variables and there are too many tests out there that have not proven to be effective.
I wasn't aware of any FDA-approved home test that was out there.
Correct. So I think when you're talking about testing, then right now the test that's been primarily approved, and even that is on an accelerated basis, are the tests that are run by certified laboratories.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Jerry of St. Luke's University Health Network. We appreciate your time and expert information.
I hope that was helpful. I always enjoy talking to you, James. Stay well.
For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting.